Hey everyone, welcome back to the 443 Security Simplified. I'm your host, Mark LaLiberty, and joining me today is...
Mr. Knockreiner.
We're coming from you almost live, just a little bit delayed from the RSA conference here.
Shh, it's live.
Sunny San Francisco. How did we do a live podcast distributed?
That doesn't matter. Okay. Magic, we're hackers.
It's live from sunny San Francisco.
We'll do it live.
Where today we're going to go over a recap of some of the talks that we saw today and some of the major topics from the conference so far. So let's go ahead and get started. We have a lot to talk about today because, I mean, at least I attended a whole bunch of sessions.
I like to start things.
Yeah. All right. So let's go ahead and start.
It's different than diving.
Oh, my goodness.
Or maybe jumping or moseying. Starting's good. Let's get started.
I can't win, can I?
Why are you slowing down, Mark? I thought we were started.
It's RSA. And it's day one. So we started with the opening keynotes, which were a few different keynote sessions.
Yeah.
Starting with Rohit Ghai. I'm probably butchering his name entirely, but he's the president of RSA. Pretty important dude in the company and for the conference as a whole.
I guess.
Yeah. And he
sometimes presidents are important. Sometimes they're kind of, yeah.
Exactly. Yes. Just meh. So the whole, I guess we should start with the theme of the whole conference, which is all about the human element in security. And I feel like his talk really went on that. He talked about the need for humans to still be there to solve issues that aren't solved by artificial intelligence, for example.
Because we're all going to be automated out of jobs soon.
I mean, he kind of started out the talk with, you all suck at security and we're going to place you with AI. Okay, makes sense to me.
Aren't humans the ones that make the machine learning? Are we sure we don't suck at that too?
You've clearly never seen the documentary Terminator to see how that ends. He had a few interesting points throughout his talk that I liked. He talked about how, like, in the news, we only hear about, like, the industry losses. So, like, when security failures happen is when it generates news. A lot of people are afraid to celebrate their security wins, even though we should.
Yeah.
Because
I think we don't realize that, like, 99% we're having wins all day.
Yeah.
I mean, sorry to go a little product-y audience, but one of the things we sell is a security product. And the sad thing is, if you actually look at your, like, if it's doing its job, you almost don't even notice.
Mm-hmm.
You never notice it unless you go and look at the logs and see the, you know, oh, it's actually blocked 1 million malware samples in the past, you know, year.
1 million. Wow. You have some really fish prone end users if you're blocking a million malware samples.
Gotta exaggerate a little. I guess on the level we look at it in our internet security report, million comes easily.
Yes.
But the point being is there's actually there's a lot we could celebrate in the background. For every hit, there's probably thousands of misses.
And he did point out that it's not a zero-sum game. It doesn't mean someone wins, someone loses all the time. Like the city of Atlanta, they technically didn't win because they lost millions of dollars because of that, like recovering from that ransomware attack. But the attackers didn't win either because Atlanta held off on paying the ransom.
And maybe they have won long run, as even though it costs them money, if you can actually keep the cyber criminals from earning money, the amount of attacks will, you know, if you take away their money source, it's not interesting to them.
Exactly. And he had some good basic tips in there, too. Like he talked about you don't need the security expert with like 3 state-of-the-art monitors at his desk to keep you safe from cyber threats.
Wait a second. I remember that hacker skit we did. I guess 3 is not enough.
Like
you
6.
Need 6. I thought that was like a core part of us hackers, man.
I think we still have that monitor stand. I need to get that installed at my desk now that I think about it.
Don't tell this to our bosses. We'll lose. Prakash won't give us the budget for our WatchGuard Threat Lab anymore.
Exactly. But anyways, you say you don't need that person. Like, start with the basics and go from there. So like he even said, just basics like multi-factor authentication can go a long ways towards protecting your company.
That sounds like some pretty new advice I've never heard before.
Exactly.
Yeah. I think I could get on board with that. Probably a product out there called Authpoint.
Yeah, great. It's the best. Following after him was Stephen Grobman, the CTO of McAfee. He talked about like a lot of practical security tips too, like Bluekeep, which is the RDP vulnerability that was discovered like a few years ago now. Maybe it was only last year. I don't know.
I think it might have been last year. I remember when the MSP attacks happened that we're talking about, RDP was a commonality.
Still has been like about a year, but only
Bluekeep was around during that.
Only 60% of internet-facing systems have actually had that addressed on them.
That seems nuts, man. If you haven't patched Bluekeep, you're... Whoa. Yeah. I hope you're not exposing RDP without more access control.
We talked about Eternal Blue, which is the vulnerabilities set of vulnerabilities that fueled WannaCry.
I thought it was one of those fancy colors you get in makeup.
I like how everything's blue. Is blue like Microsoft's color? I'm missing something, apparently.
Everything's eternal, right? I think if you look at the other... There's a lot of other SMB vulnerabilities that were in the NSA leak.
But he mentioned even 2.5, like almost 3 years now after the fact, it is still the top detected exploit by their sensor array out there. Talked about, he showed an example of a SHA-1 collision in the RSA marketing material, basically.
He pointed out that two documents, RSA documents, that he could generate a collision in. It used to be like it would take a long freaking time to figure out a collision.
He said it cost him $60,000 in like cloud computing, which is doable for a keynote at RSA.
What was the time that he said?
I don't remember the exact time.
It was
short.
Under a day.
Yes. He did mention it was still very expensive, but not out of reach for like nation states or really motivated cyber criminals. He talked about an attack against AWS where a lot of our cloud computing systems interface with each other without credentials, really. But they still have metadata that can be used to authenticate them to other systems. So he showed a practical attack of going through and stealing credentials off an EC2 cloud compute system and then hitting an S3 bucket or something. Really, it was kind of interesting stuff.
Yeah.
And then the next talker was Wendy Nather?
Talker.
The next talker. Keynoter.
Yeah, talker. That should be what we say we do when we go to presentation.
We're talkers.
Talker. Hey.
I mean, you are, but.
Oh.
She's from Duo, now Cisco. And her talk was really interesting. It was all about.
Who are those guys, man? Don't know about that. But MFA from Authpoint, that sounds pretty cool.
She talked about democratizing security, though, which is something that I think both of us really got on board with.
I kid, but I actually liked her talk. It was good.
Yeah. So she came with like 3 bullet points of what we can do to help democratize security. So change from a control model to a collaboration model, meaning instead of telling people like you have to do this, blah, 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 work with them in order to get them access while still maintaining strong security, get people to buy into your security strategy as opposed to just telling them what to do.
The one thing I think we've talked about before, I kind of hate and I get mad at the IT administrators that are too much the loser, as in the L user, you know, it's the users just so stupid they can't learn. Security awareness is pointless because they're just dumb users that will make mistakes. I'm going to tell them exactly what to do, and if they don't do it, they're in trouble. That's just, I think, IT silly if they still have that mentality. Because one, your employees are smart people. They may not be security experts because that's not what they were trained in, but they're smart accountants, they're smart finance people, whatever they are. So I think that kind of attitude's silly. So her whole idea of, you know, not being the draconian enforcer, but getting those people to want to adopt security.
Yeah.
And they actually probably know more about the risk, especially the business risk, and to the stuff they deal with, than you as the IT guy or the security professional. You know, they know where the finance important data is, or the engineering code is, and what are the types of threats to different parts of their system. So she even said, you know, rather than going and telling them how to secure stuff, you actually ask them, hey, what do you think we should do to secure it, which was good.
Yep.
The final thing I like that she really talked about is, I believe in security awareness, and I think a great way to get adoption is security awareness isn't just something you have to do for your employer anymore. We all have mobile phones. We all, in our personal life, use digital stuff all the time. We need security awareness just for living life and not losing our own personal bank accounts. So it's pretty easy to position, you know, this type of adoption of security as beneficial for you, let alone the employer. So she really talked about great ways to collaborate and get people to want to be on board rather than coming down as the
Yeah, that was a part of her... like third bullet point, which is open it to everyone also. Her second bullet point was simplify design.
Yeah.
So just she used a really extreme example in my opinion.
Yeah, we believe in simplicity, but security does have some complexity. So let's hear her example.
She pulled a spoon out of her pocket and goes, you know what this is? Like you learned how to use a spoon when you were a toddler.
I don't know. Is it a spork?
You know, yes. Well done, Corey.
Obviously, I guess some people are losers. Kindergarten.
She pointed out that yes, you don't need annual spoon awareness training in order to continue knowing how to use a spoon. So
I
thought
I've hurt myself before.
It was an extreme example, but it does like it. She has a good point of really trying to simplify security so people can buy into it.
Yeah, yeah. Although I will say, like, I think you agree, the analogy was a fun way to make a point. But while you can simplify security and get people to help out, and there is some common sense security, it's a little more complex than just a spoon.
Exactly. But still a pretty good talk.
Yeah.
And she was...
She's a good talker.
She's a good talker. She should do more talking. I think she was the last of the main keynote speakers before they hopped into an RSA staple. Which is the cryptographers panel, something they do every year. They usually bring up the R, the
wizards.
S, and the A from RSA.
We do all the maths.
Exactly. This year they had a few new people. They had Diffie Hellman on there with his glorious gray locks of hair.
By the way, I noticed you just said Diffie Hellman because we deal with IPsec a lot. But yes, Whitfield Diffie is one of the people that Mr. helped create the Diffie Hellman.
Yes. Anyways, it was a panel where they basically opened it up to not just cryptography, but really just discussions on security. So they started out talking about AI and its uses, its limitations. I thought they made a really good point that, so you and I have talked about a few times of when it comes to like image recognition, you can change a few pixels or put a sticker next to something and completely hose the algorithm into thinking it's something else.
Yep.
And they basically said, until we can fix that problem, we probably shouldn't trust like AI neural networks to drive our cars or make medical decisions.
And I forget, I'm sorry for forgetting you, researcher, but I think a female researcher just literally proved that particular thing. There's a situation where I think she used the rock salt, the same rock salt you'd use in ice, and she created a fake rock salt lane, and the AI car just think, oh, look at my lane marker. I'm now going to pay attention to that rock salt and let it guide me wherever.
Exactly.
So a good example of how little pixels may be interpreted differently by an automated car.
They talked about facial recognition too and issues with that. One of the first points they made was that it's asymmetrical, meaning like when you and I talk, like I can see that you are looking at me and you can see I'm looking at you.
We've kind of validated that we're sharing each other's image and we know that we both... recognize one another.
Your listeners cannot see the cringe that I just made there.
Yes. But. He loves me looking at him. Stare deep into my eyes, Mark.
All right. So the benefit of facial recognition then is it's asymmetrical, so you don't know that they're looking at you.
Yeah.
It is a drawback.
Speaking of which, that hidden Waze camera I have by your desk. Oh, never mind.
It's actually mine to keep a tab on. But they made the point that there's cameras everywhere. You don't always know where the cameras are. Yeah. And so because of that, it's a bit of a concern. They talked about data.
Asymmetric ability to recognize people when you don't know they're recognizing
you. Talked about data permanence, like they're taking pictures, matching it to a database. Where do they store them? How long do they store them? That's a genuine privacy concern.
Yep.
And then they talked about three other points. So identification, correlation, and discrimination issues. So how do you match up with someone? How accurate it is? They talked about discrimination in the form of targeted advertisements towards specific people. So like areas that we might need to look into in terms of regulation before we just start rolling out this technology.
Even to add to the discrimination, I forget which keynote it was in this block of keynotes, but when we're talking about machine learning and AI, you know, we don't always talk about machine learning over learning. Like you can create a machine learning algorithm to do something with facial recognition. You're like, I want you to be able to help me recognize who these images are based on another image database, but then it will overlearn and start to have some racial discrimination just based on the color of skin. And you weren't trying to train for that, but machine learning is known to pick up on weird indicators that become features of the algorithm. So a good example of this database may be starting to have even unintended discrimination effects.
They brought up the topic of right to be forgotten came up, which is pretty big these days with GDPR and the California.
CCPA. Yep. Soon to be a lot more.
One of them made a point that really the right to be forgotten only draws attention to your request to be forgotten. Like it's really hard to scrub data off the internet, basically. And they brought up a story of some Spanish gentleman.
That's an interesting new intelligence. Like if I were an intelligence agency, I might be wondering who is asking to be forgotten everywhere.
Exactly. But they did say that they proposed a name change to right to be delisted. So knowing that you're not going to be able to scrub everything off the internet, like the Wayback Machine is still a thing, like the web archive. But you can at least have power over, say, search engines from making that information easily accessible, so that you have some control over who has access to that data. Like it, they mentioned in an interview, maybe you had like a criminal record, and while you don't want to necessarily hide the criminal record, you want to be able to provide context in the interview as opposed to them just finding it and writing you off right off the bat. They've talked a lot about tech and voting. The topic of blockchain came up and how it's just wholly inappropriate. I think that was the question itself, was like, can blockchain protect voting or something like that? And they basically yep. said it's entirely inappropriate for that use, because blockchain, all it is like immutable permanence of data. And they brought up the quip, garbage in, garbage stored forever.
Yeah.
Which makes sense.
Yeah. That, by the way, it doesn't mean blockchain's bad, but for the people that don't get it, I mean, blockchain is this immutable ledger of whatever you put into it. And if it has bad data at the start, it's now forever. Unchangeable.
Yep.
Unless you fork it.
Unless you fork it. Yes. It
goes with spoons, forks.
They made the point that, in their opinion, paper ballots are just fine. Like a user verifiable paper ballot is good security. You can't hack a paper ballot. I mean, I guess you could.
I agree. I do think for scale that we all have to get used to digital voting. But as you and I have talked about a number of times, paper backups have to be a requirement for whatever system we adopt.
Yep. I thought it was funny the topic of quantum cryptography and post-quantum encryption came up, and Ram Rivest said, I hope the builders of quantum computers fail.
Surprised I didn't say that for AI.
Because, well, in this case, it's specifically because most of these quantum cryptography studies are trying to break RSA encryption.
Yeah.
And that's his baby.
But I actually think that's a silly statement, because yeah. one of the other things they talked about on the cryptographer's panel was when they started talking about this. I forget who exactly said this, but he thought that cryptography would be a short field because eventually they'd solve it and come up with one encryption algorithm that would be the one to rule them all, and that would be it. And he realized that, wait a second, cryptography is an ever-changing thing that's going to continue. And that's actually a neat subject. Yeah. You know, if you like cryptography, yeah, it's going to get harder and different depending on what types of compute technology we have and, you know, new mathematical functions we probably discover that we don't even know yet. But it's kind of a neat idea that means cryptography is never going to have just one algorithm that works perfectly forever.
I have to imagine he was saying with a little bit of tongue-in-cheek there.
Yeah, I'm sure it was a joke.
So I managed to make it to a few other...
Although I'm okay with quantum computers failing, just because whenever I think of qubits and things not being in the right state until I actually look at it, it kind of hurts my brain a little.
Maybe with a quantum computer, I can finally play Witcher 3 in 4K.
That's true. With the way Cyberpunk 2077 is going, we might need quantum computers.
Exactly. So I went to a few more specific talks after the keynotes, too. Some of them were pretty interesting. The first one was billed as...
Lucky? I wish I knew your boss who paid for that cool pass that I don't have.
Thanks for the Christmas present. First one was billed as Shodan 2.0.
Whoa, which... that's cool. Big update to Shodan. Tell me more.
So if you're not familiar with Shodan, I'm sure we've talked about it a few times
on
the podcast.
Have.
But it's basically a search engine. It's called the search engine for IoT, but it's really any server, anything out there.
Anything on the internet, yeah. Although the cool thing it really focuses on is devices that aren't easily recognized.
Basically, instead of going across the internet trying to find websites and their web content to build a
although
Google
that's
search
there
engine,
too. Yeah.
They go through to find open ports, open protocols, try and fingerprint them with banners and headers and stuff,
yeah.
and then display that in a easily searchable engine.
And so, if you didn't know, a lot of those headers, you know, leak a lot of information about what kind of the device it is, just based on, it wouldn't be a user agent header, but in a server response, there's sometimes even specific version numbers of what you're dealing with.
You can find credentials in it leaked out sometimes.
That's crazy.
So, like, attackers can use it as reconnaissance before, like, to try and find targets for a botnet, for example.
Yeah.
Researchers can use it when a new vulnerability comes out to figure
that's
out
what I've, you've
what the,
done before.
The wide field is.
The attack
like,
surfaces.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So in this case, it wasn't like a total overhaul of Shodan. It was really some specific upgrades specific to the energy sector. So this was from Michael Mylrin, who's from GE. And GE, as you know, works a lot in the energy sector. And he was...
Who would have guessed? General Electric?
Exactly.
I thought they made fridges.
So his research actually started after they recognized like there have been several really high profile attacks against energy distribution systems in the last few years. Like Ukraine got hit pretty hard, their whole power grid or a large portion of it got shut down a few years ago. There were talks of people probing the U.S. grid, for example. And so he went and petitioned with a few other people, the Department of Energy, to try and augment and update Shodan as a defensive tool for utility districts and power distribution companies.
And defensive as in help them find the problem so they could fix it.
Exactly. Because a lot of the times he talked about how IT and OT networks, so information technology and operational technology networks, are kind of converging sometimes oftentimes in a really insecure way on just like a flat network where they're all together now.
Yeah, that air gap that OT should have had or at least had for a certain period of time is now gone because they're connected directly to the IT networks.
You might not know what devices you have connected to your network in terms of industrial control systems. And so they were actually granted funding, but funny enough.
Funny funding
from the DOE.
Funny money.
they almost got the funding taken away thanks to an episode of your favorite show, Mr. Robot.
Go, Elliot.
Where it was like right after they got the funding, Elliot used Shodan on the show to like identify a target as reconnaissance for an attack. And the DOE goes, why are we funding a hacking tool, basically?
But that's the point. I mean, calling Shodan a hacking tool is kind of ruining the intention. I mean, the whole point is to openly find all the problems. Yes, you could use that for bad reasons, but they're funding the fact that they want to find these weaknesses. So if you put them in a public tool where anyone can find them, I bet you those energy companies will go fix them quick.
Exactly.
At least they should. I bet you can still use Shodan to find a lot.
I mean, it was Mr. CTO from McAfee who was pointing out there's still 60% of the original hosts vulnerable to Bluekeep out there. So yes. But one of their main goals is making it really easy for people to have like reports and analytics on their own systems because of like the cybersecurity skills gap, which is really affecting ICS, he said. He mentioned that in terms of security systems like firewalls are actually often one of the major points of entry because of misconfigurations or unpatched vulnerabilities. Believe it or not, people kind of suck at keeping their systems up to date.
Or at just configuring access controls that they actually have. You know, you might have a lot of capability with a product, including a firebox, but if you maybe didn't understand how to configure it properly, you might leave an opening you don't realize you had.
So long story short, though, they used all of their research to create these predefined searching and reporting parameters within Shodan now, where specifically to the energy sector. You can have predefined search queries. You can set it up to monitor your own IP address range so you can have visibility into your systems there. And it was pretty interesting. I wouldn't call it Shodan 2.0, but I think that for this specific sector, it actually will be pretty useful to them, especially with organizations that might not have like the dedicated security people, but have an IT person that can at least use Shodan.
Cool stuff.
Next talk I went to was all about, it was supposed to be about the Internet of Medical IoT, but it was really about quite a bit more than that.
Internet of Medical Internet of Things
Internet
is
of
a
medical,
little redundant.
Yeah, well, it's like an ATM machine, right?
And don't we call medical IoT OT?
Whatever. It was by Amar Lakhani. He already gave us permission to butcher his name entirely.
Thank you for that, Amar.
He blamed it on his dad.
Amar, by the way, yes. I think it's Amir.
No, it is Amar.
Oh, really?
He specifically said it's Amar.
My goodness.
He said you have to forget everything about spelling and punctuation.
This is where Western spelling screws up.
Thank you.
That's your phonetic spelling in this nice, wonderful document you gave me.
You're welcome.
Of course, I ignored it.
Of course, just like everything. His research topic started by just asking the question of why so many medical institutions are being breached lately. His first slide was like 10 different major breaches from the last like 2 years of just millions and millions of records in the medical industry. And then using that, him and his own research team went and looked at like X-ray devices and anesthesia machines and emergency responder communication systems, and actually found quite a few CVEs within them. Like, they're able to get malware running on an X-ray machine, which is kind of interesting.
Not really surprised.
Yeah.
I happen to know that a lot of blood pumps around Windows something 2003. So yes. I really am not surprised that they have a lot of vulnerabilities.
He looked into like on the dark web medical records for sale. He found like several dumps, including like 6 million records from New York, where he actually went and contacted the seller in this case and asked for proof. And the seller set up a TeamViewer session with them.
That's nice.
He pointed out that, you know, TeamViewer, maybe they're going to try and hack my computer. So I use like this completely air-gapped laptop on like an LTE network, a completely office network. But he got in contact with the seller, and the seller pulled up Amar's own medical records to as proof of this. And Amar goes, well, what the heck? I don't live in New York. He goes, oh, well, your insurance company works with this entity based out of New York. So basically, it's all there. Pretty insane stuff. You pointed out that like people ask, like, what? Why are these so valuable? Why would anyone want my medical records? You can use it as identity theft fuel. Really common, you can use it as an attacker for billing fraud. So set up fake or pretend doctor's visits and bill the insurance provider $500 per visit. And over time, you can make quite a bit of money. He found legitimate medicine for sale on the dark web, which was interesting. So insulin, he went over the talk of how it's like $400 normally without insurance, but you can get it for $200 a dose.
Not surprising. I've heard of insurance companies actually paying for people's trip to Latin America because it's cheaper for them to pay for medicine than the United States. And frankly, Silk Road has had not just illicit drugs, but quite regular medicine at cheap prices for a long time.
A 10-minute portion of his talk was rightfully bashing the U.S. healthcare industry, basically, for this whole thing. Then he looked into like apps and tools around diabetes. So he found one that would ask permissions, a whole bunch of excessive permissions when you install it. And it was really just like an app for information on the disease. But then it would, in the background, send texts to a short code number that billed $200 per text.
Oh, my gosh.
There was another app that you had to, it required you to install like 8 different adware applications before you could gain access to it. And these had like thousands of installations, he found. And he even like contacted some people that were using it. He goes, what the heck? Why would you accept this? And they go, well, I have no option. I need this and it's free.
Probably free, some iOS apps, right?
Exactly.
What food?
Kidding. Yes, exactly. My favorite part was an actual IoT hack where I guess there's this thing where instead of pricking your finger to check glucose levels, you can get a little patch.
Much nicer.
It just sits on your skin and monitors glucose over time. It supposedly expires after like 14 days, but they were able to dump the firmware and find in the memory where that expiration date was set. And you could just keep resetting it and it would keep working.
So just money grubbing.
I'm assuming it had something to do with the battery and being like safe rather than sorry.
I guess that's true.
But still, like at least until the battery dies, you could keep using it. There were other flaws in it, though. Like, it communicated over NFC with zero authentication at all. Like, not even 0000 as a password.
I wonder how far NFC sniping. To be fair, NFC takes short range. Yes. But I think you can get it a little further than average.
You mentioned you just go accidentally rub shoulders with someone.
Yeah, elevators are a great place to get some NFC.
Exactly. Dump the entire database off the little chip thing, too. So it was interesting. And then he ended up talking about like stolen insurance ID cards in the dark web, which were selling for $500 for people that want to go basically go to a doctor's visit and not pay, I guess, because they came with a free ID as well that you could get stolen. So interesting talk, more than just IoT. When he was testing those NFC chip glucose monitors, he used a wet sponge with hot water and sugar to simulate his arm. And I guess that worked perfectly.
Fun Sounds fact. Like what we are, 90% water and
wet
pretty much
sugar
sponge.
And a sponge.
Yeah.
The next
a lot
talk
of carbon and water.
Yes. The last talk I went to was actually really interesting. It was Isaac Dver and Yaniv Balmas out of a Checkpoint, actually, and their research team, where they went over a
stuff.
Few different research topics that they've been working on. The talk was all about getting rid of the incorrect assumptions about security across a whole bunch of different areas. So like, for example, mobile phones are too expensive to hack or too secure or something like that.
Who had these?
Mobile networks, rather. I don't know.
I feel like in the security community anyways, that's not a myth statement.
Pitch,
we all believe it.
The pitch might
or
be
cameras
BS.
Can be hacked. Yeah, we know.
The research was pretty cool, though. So like they started with a DSLR camera, which supported P2P, PTP or picture transfer protocol, more commonly advertised as just transfer your pictures over Wi-Fi. They found fresh out of the box, take a couple pictures with it, and then using just a laptop with Linux and a USB dongle, you could connect to the camera, install ransomware on it, and then lock everything until they pay you, which is kind of interesting. They went after mobile devices where he mentioned, he showed a video of Snowden actually, who was saying that mobile devices are the next big frontier because they're always beaconing home. Here I am, here I am. And he mentioned that part of that beacon is they're trying to find a cell tower, and cell towers will send down a message once they get that beacon with some configuration stuff for like SMS servers or proxy servers. And with a $30 GSM module and some software, he could fake a GSM tower, send out that configuration message with a proxy server set, and then he could basically man in the middle everything. Yeah, he showed using Beef, which is a tool we've talked about a few times, to
browser exploitation framework.
Yep, set up a phishing website for Gmail.
That, I think the cool part of that, like, that's not anything new to us in theory. Like, we all know about the government stingrays. You've probably heard of femdecels. Like, in the past, the way you, as a cheap hacker, could try to man in the middle cell used to be femdecels. If you could root a femdecel, it could become a mini tower you can man in the middle. But what is cool about this is the price of that $30 GMS dongle. And this is really how a lot of these hacks work. A lot of them aren't new, but as they, the same with software defined radio, when you bring that price down, you're really lowering the bar, and that's when cyber criminals are going to start picking it up and using it for real.
Yep. He talked about email as an attack vector. Their research was into a file type called ACE, which is from like the early 1990s.
Compression. I just don't make fun of that. I remember some sites that used ACE when it was a little better than ZIP, than WinRAR came out.
I do vaguely remember it myself as well.
Yeah, there's a period of time when some underground sites might have used ACE more commonly than RAR.
Yes. As of right now, though, WinRAR is the only application that supports it, or at least was.
I'm surprised it still does. I don't think I've seen an ACE file in a decade, if not more.
They found a vulnerability in it, though, where you could set up a malicious archive where when you go to extract it, it extracts whatever the contents are and wherever you tell it to, but then it also extracts a malware payload into whatever directory you want. So
that's,
they give
cool.
an example of the startup directory.
There's been a lot of, you find in parsers, and really a compression program or decompression program is just a parser.
Yep.
There's been lots of classic vulnerabilities that were due to compression files, so it's nice to see a new one. And I think the cool angle on this is an unused file type that people, that just kind of makes it benign because you don't think about what it is.
When you go to download your wares.
Oh, who said wares? What are those, Mark? I've never heard of wares before.
After he brought this up, WinRAR actually removed their support of the ACE file type, so now it's dead for good, I guess.
Oh, well, that's a bummer.
Then they went into actually a really interesting bit of their talk where they talked about SQLite, which is a database application really commonly used in like mobile apps,
everything,
and browser extensions and desktop apps.
Said, like it says, it's light, so it's a great way to use a SQL database with not much resource.
There's over a trillion installations globally of it.
I feel like we've used it and stuff before.
Yep. He also mentioned it's because of that, it's one of the most audited databases that are out there. Like, there's a ton of security researchers going over it to try and find vulnerabilities in the code. There was a pretty serious one they found back in 2015 that enabled code execution when a malicious database is loaded into whatever the application is. Originally, they showed the exploitation of this was through Chrome and Safari, which actually had like a web API where if you went to a site, it could use JavaScript to load up a SQLite database right there in the browser. And that's how they got code execution on those systems.
Cool.
But that was patched back in 2015.
Yeah.
In the browsers, not in the database application itself.
Oops.
And so this vulnerability had been sitting there for 5 years now, and they went through and found some more uses for it. His first one was pretty dang funny. So they had it turns out like SQLite's really commonly used to store credentials for like applications, like my mobile app or desktop app or something.
If you have a web app, usually you need a way for people to log on, and embedded stuff, it's an easy way to have a password database.
Which means that malware, info stealing malware out there, some of it's built specifically to look for SQLite databases, steal it, and then send it back to a command and control server.
Fun.
So they set up a malicious SQLite database on a computer that was wide open. It got infected with info stealing malware. It stole the database, loaded it up on its command and control server, and they were able to gain a web
Pop
shell.
The bad guys.
On that command and control server.
That's always fun when you can get them back through their own.
Also, I think still technically illegal. I think that's considered hacking back.
It is, and
morally
officially
good.
Officially don't like it, but it is fun
wrong.
To hear about.
Yes. Then they had another really interesting one where they used it to gain persistence on iOS. So it turns out the contact list on iOS uses SQLite to store all that data. And you can replace that one with a malicious one where even when you reload the phone, reboot it, reinstall, as soon as you sync that contact list, the malware comes right back. And this technically bypasses Secure Boot on iOS.
That's big. Does it bypass it or is it more about it because it comes back?
Bypass because it doesn't matter if it's there at all.
Yeah.
So they mentioned that like if you can get persistence on iOS, it's worth like $2 to $4 million.
Oh, absolutely. I do think actually Android remote roots are for once worth more than iPhone, but they go for... Do we have a rat in our closet?
Ice.
But yes, iOS 0-day remote roots are a big deal.
But if it bypasses or at least negates Secure Boot, it's double.
Oh, wow.
And so they got a substantial bug bounty from
couple million?
Like six different CVEs they got out of this one.
Fun.
Really interesting stuff. And then they ended talking about the Joker malware, which has been around for a bit. It's a dropper on Android named after the app it was originally found in. Where it goes and grabs a second stage, usually like the malware itself doesn't really have malicious code. It just calls home, grabs the malicious code, and then runs that.
Downloader of sorts.
Click fraud, steal SMS messages, sets up a notification listener to grab SMS messages to sign people up for premium services, for example. So it was a good like mix of a bunch of different security topics and some pretty good research.
It sounds like their research team just doing a dump of the cool stuff they've done the last year or so.
Exactly. So that was it from my end on RSA. It was a pretty busy day, and I've got quite a few more interesting talks tomorrow to line up for, too. And I think you're going to hit some more keynotes also.
Yeah, because I have the little boring pass. I have to stick with the probably business-level stuff, but I'll give a little bit of insight to that tomorrow.
I get the fun stuff.
Exactly.
Because I'm still a hacker.
Oh, bite me. Bite me, Mark. I know things you haven't even got to yet.
Whatever, pop popcorn. Hey everyone, thanks again for listening. As always, if you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe.
Send tips.
If you have any questions on today's topics or suggestions for future topics, or if there's a talk that you see at RSA that you think we should go to and cover, reach out to us on Twitter. I'm at @XORRO_, Corey's at @SecAdept, and the both of us are at #The443Podcast. Thanks again for listening, and we will see you probably much earlier than next week.
#Ciao. #See you later.
#.
Bye.